Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, one of the world's most celebrated contemporary architects shares his creative process. Daniel Libeskind is known for exteriors that read like sculpture on a massive scale. The post-9/11 redesign of the World Trade Center, the Jewish Museum Berlin, and the Imperial War Museum in England. Libeskind's personal story is as compelling as his work. He was born to Holocaust survivors in a homeless shelter in Poland, earned fame as an 11-year-old accordion prodigy in Israel, and pursued an architecture degree at Cooper Union only at the behest of his mother, who wanted him to have some practical skills to fall back on. Our conversation starts after a short break. Architect Daniel Libeskind is the creative force behind some of the world's most celebrated structures. Sculptural buildings, including the Jewish Museum Berlin, the post-9/11 World Trade Center, and the curving residential towers that sway up from Singapore's Keppel Bay like river reeds in the breeze. You don't have to be an expert in architecture to recognize the genius in his work. Libeskind himself, he believes anyone can be an architect. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Daniel Libeskind earned his degree in architecture from Cooper Union in 1970 and spent decades as a theorist and professor before winning the commission to design the Jewish Museum Berlin. Since then, dozens of his works have been constructed around the world. And in a new retrospective book about his work, Libeskind explains how he developed the practices and philosophies that guide his work. The book is called Edge of Order, and we are delighted to have him here to talk about it. Daniel, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
When you say you believe anyone can be an architect, you're pushing back pretty hard against the elitism that can sometimes creep into your profession. Why do you think that happens?
Well, you know, architecture seems to most people very opaque. You know, why is a building looking the way it does? How did it just appear on my street? Who did it? How did it materialize? And yet, you know, to sort of demystify that field, you know, it's a simple thing. You can pick up a pencil, you can make a drawing, you can compose a song. Why can you not build a building or become a participant in building your city? So I think everyone who is alive has an experience to be an architect. And I think in the future, people will do that.
What did Le Corbusier say about what one needed to be an architect?
Well, Le Corbusier had a very simple thing. He said, you know, you don't have to go to school. You don't have to acquire the knowledge of the technical codes. You don't have to follow what is being offered, you know, in the fashions of architecture. All you need to do is travel and read some books. And that is a very profound thought, because architecture comes from life, from experience, and from perception. And I think anyone who is creative, and everyone is, can really be part of it.
You've done a lot of travel, starting when you were a child. You were born a year after World War II ended to Jewish parents in Poland. Your early childhood, you say, was marked by this sense of a lot of lingering anti-Semitism in Poland.
Well, anti-Semitism, state-sponsored anti-Semitism, but also dictatorship. It was a communist dictatorship I grew up under. And when you grow up under that kind of oppression, while not assimilating to it, but resisting it, you become aware of the forces that make people into, you know, gray bodies moving silently through streets. And you begin to think that there must be a better world. So, yes, that's definitely part of my experience till I was, you know, 13 years old. That was my world, a gray one, and a world where people were oppressed all around me by totalitarianism, by dictatorship. So, yes, you sort of begin to think, you know, there must be a way out of this without just submitting to it.
So in 1957, your family was finally allowed to leave Poland, and you call Israel, where you ended up for a while, your first paradise. What did you love about it?
Well, first of all, I saw the world in color. Hmm. You know, when I lived in Poland, it was all just gray, dark. People had the same expression. There was silence on the streets. There was total conformity. The minute I saw the Mediterranean, the beautiful blue skies, people being free at liberty to do, oh my God, that was really arriving in paradise. I was in shock, state of shock, to see the beauty of the world. The world is beautiful when people are allowed to do what they want to do, when they are, and when you are not oppressed by forces that are sort of controlling you.
You had, even in Poland, a certain amount of artistic freedom because you fell in love with music. But you wanted to play the piano, and your parents felt like getting a piano into your apartment would attract too much attention. So what did they give you instead?
Well, they told me they have a piano, but it was in a suitcase. It happened to be the accordion. It was a pretty large accordion. It was almost my size, many octaves. And I was kind of destined to play that instrument, though I wanted to play the piano. But I love the instrument because it's, you know, you have to pull the bellows. It has two different keyboards. And I transcribed classical music, you know, exclusively. I didn't play, you know, folk songs. I played serious, you know, Baroque music and Bach and so on. And so when I came to Israel, I was able to compete in a fantastic musical, you know, competition where I actually met for the first time Itzhak Perelman, the great violinist.
And he too was just quite young back then.
Yes, he competed in the same competition. Of course, there were hundreds of kids, you know. You know, everybody was with a cello, with a violin, with a flute, something serious. I was too, you know, weak to even carry my accordion into the jury room, so my father carried it for me. And I remember when I opened the suitcase and started, you know, to take out this huge instrument, the judges of the competition, which included also Isaac Stern, who was the head of the jury, looked at me like I landed from Mars. You know, what was I doing there? This is not you know, for folk music. This is a serious classical music competition. But the minute I started playing, and I remembered I played the Toccata in D minor by Bach, the first three chords, suddenly their smiles disappeared. They started listening seriously. And, you know, I ended my piece with Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee, which is really a technically, you know, beautiful, challenging piece. And that was it. And there were smiles. And Isaac Stern came over to me and said, "Oh, my God, Mr. Libeskind, you've already exhausted everything you can possibly do on this instrument. You have to play the piano." But as I said, you know, it's very hard to go from the vertical keyboard to the horizontal. And that's maybe why I'm an architect, because architecture is definitely a vertical keyboard.
So you moved actually from music into an obsession with drawing. Did you literally sort of put the accordion away and start drawing all the time when you had time?
No. I continued to play the accordion when I came to New York. I played in serious classical performances in Tower Hall and many other venues. But I always loved to draw from childhood. And drawing is such a fascinating art because it's very close to music. You know, music also is produced in a score that has lines and numbers and points and geometries, and so does an architectural drawing, or even just the drawing of a landscape is made in the same way. So I found those two fields, music and architecture, or music and drawing, very, very close to each other. And I was obsessed with drawing.
Do you experience music in three dimensions, if that makes any sense?
Oh, absolutely, it makes sense. When I listen to music, definitely there are spaces being constructed on a maybe cosmic scale, not even an urban scale. When you listen to a toccata of Bach or a symphonic work, you have really space created in time. It's almost architecture. It's kind of frozen music, it has been said, but it's not just frozen. It's also dynamic and moves your emotions. And in that sense, I think very close to architecture, because both of them are highly intellectual, very disciplined arts, scientific in many ways, very precise. But at the end, you have to communicate to your heart. You have to fall in love with something beyond just thinking about what you're listening to or what you're looking at.
So you were, what, 13 when your family moved to the Bronx?
Yes, yes.
What do you remember? What do you remember about your first glimpse of New York Harbor?
Oh my God, that memory is so deeply imprinted on my mind, because I stood on the, you know, prow of the ship. It was a big ship. It was America Holland Line, SS Mediterranean, it was called. And I stood on that prow with a lot of other immigrants, just looking at 4 o'clock in the morning. My mother woke us up and said, "You'll see New York," and that skyline of New York, which is like a Fata Morgana. It's unbelievable. Even if you see postcards of New York, or even if you see pictures of New York, nothing prepares you for the immensity of that emotion. And of course, I remember the boat went right by the Statue of Liberty, and it loomed out of the morning sky with this huge hand and the torch. Little did I know that Emma Lazarus wrote that beautiful poem on it: "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled messes, yearning to breathe free." How moving. But that was my experience. I was just like millions of immigrants who came to this country and had the same experience, just looking out into an unknown future, but with the kind of excitement of possibilities that America and New York offer.
When you were a teenager, you went to a high school that focused on science and math, but your the projects that you got really passionate about were like making dioramas.
Well, I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which apparently has produced more Nobel Prizes than all of France.
Wow.
It was at that time an amazing, you know, it still is, amazing school for people with true abilities in mathematics and the sciences. But I drifted, of course, to my own interest, which is, you know, how to make something. So while people were doing experiments in physics, atomic physics particularly, to catch up, you know, with the Russians and space technology at that time, I was building, you know, models of, let's say, what does a shelter look like? You know, an atomic shelter. How is it organized? How does it look with, you know, three-dimensional figures and all the things that have to be there for, you know, a family? So, yes, I was doing crazy things. And people looked at me as, what am I doing in that fantastic school? Of course, I loved science and mathematics, but I was attracted to three-dimensional objects and, of course, into space and to light.
So your mother pushed you towards studying architecture, is that right?
Well, she didn't push me. She was too wise to push me. but, you know, I remember discussing one day, you know, at our little apartment, two-room apartment in the Bronx, and she said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to be an artist. And she looked at me and she said, you know, and she was hooking a fish, actually. She was cooking a fish and she said, look, you can be... why don't you be an architect? Because you can always be an artist in architecture, but you cannot be an architect in art. And in this sense, you can catch two fish with one hook. And I remember thinking about it because I wanted to be an artist. That was my sort of dream. But I was lucky to go to school when I went to Cooper Union that the first year you could choose to be either a painter, a sculptor, or an architect. And then the next year you decide whether to, you know, what to do. So it was my mother's wisdom, and I'm so glad that she had that insight into architecture as an art.
And your professors at Cooper Union encouraged students to build really or to design really extraordinary things, even if that meant an uphill climb for getting anything built. And for you, that was exactly what you needed.
Well, I was so lucky. You know, my school, there were many, you know, great architects and thinkers in that school who really believed that, you know, architecture has another life beyond just, you know, corporate gray buildings, you know, in quantities. That architecture is an art and one could develop it through drawings, through studies, through archaeology, through history. So, yes, it allowed me really to think freely and not be forced to sort of have the school appear to be like a little office experience that would be, you know, my life later on. So, yes, it was a wonderful, eye-opening institution that allowed me really to dream.
You developed and studied and did theory and taught for years before you actually had a design constructed.
That's right. Well, I always thought of myself as an architect who was going to build. Hmm. I never thought of myself as, you know, a paper architect. Many of great architects of my generation were called paper architects before they built something. But I always thought I am doing architecture, but right now I don't have a client. I don't have a budget. I don't have a social context to build something. So what am I going to draw? So I wasn't going to draw fantasy castles or imaginary cities, but I developed drawings that could incorporate my thoughts about what a city could be, what a house could be, what even a piece of furniture could be. And these drawings were very abstract because they drifted between two and three-dimensional sort of design. But they did lead me to many of my works today. I did a series of drawings called Chamber Works, which were related very closely to music. And I sort of put myself wholly into these drawings, how to construct something. And think about it, anything that you can construct, whether it's a table or a house or even a whole city, requires a drawing. You have to make a drawing before you can build something, before workers can work on it, which is just like a piece of music. You know, you have to create a score before it can be performed by an orchestra. And so I suddenly understood drawing is divine. It's everything comes out of it. It's the only art. Architecture, where everything comes out of a piece of paper.
My guest is architect Daniel Libeskind. We're talking about his new retrospective book, Edge of Order. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with architect Daniel Libeskind, who is known for projects including the Jewish Museum Berlin, the Grand Canal Theater in Dublin, and the redesign of the World Trade Center District in Manhattan. We're talking about his career and his new retrospective book, Edge of Order. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. I really like thinking about you as a student, still living with your parents in that two-room apartment in the Bronx. You didn't have a proper drafting table at home, so what did you work on?
Well, you know, we had this small apartment. My sister and my parents were living there. And we had this one table, very ungainly brown Formica table that my parents had bought. And after dinner, I had to sort of clean it off and put my drawings on it. But the problem was that the table had very large curves. So it was partly straight, the edges, and then it curved around the corners. And, you know, I had to use a T-square. I didn't have a drafting board, you know, so I had to use this table. And whenever I would draw these really, you know, drawings that my teachers required, very accurate, you know, courses of brickwork and so on, very perfectly spaced, I would never know exactly at what point was I on the curve where there would be slight deflection of the right angle line. And that suddenly I realized, oh my God, if I slide the T-square slightly further, it creates all sorts of angles, really 359 other angles of the right angle. And that's probably, you know, that ungainly Formica table with those round edges probably made me who I am, because I discovered that architecture has so many possibilities, geometrically and spatially. Had I had a bigger house with a drafting table, I maybe have never built the buildings I'm building today. So yes, the table is an important part of my experience.
You say that 90% of what you do is pretty conventional and it has to follow all the rules of, you know, a building that is structurally sound. And then 10% is the amount that you can play with. And your buildings look so unique. It seems like they must be much more than 10% different from everything else.
Actually, it's not true. You know, buildings have to use well-tested knowledge, empirical knowledge of structure, of all the systems, sustainability, how they are well-crafted. But you need 10%, maybe even less, 7 or 5%, to really form that space with light and with a sense of mission and with a sense of doing something that is interesting and that is really adequate to the problem that you're solving. And, you know, look, we differ, I think, from the frog, I think, in DNA, only 5% different, or from a chicken, 3% difference in DNA. So 5%, 10% is really a big leap in architecture. And it can really open up really new horizons of how we can live and how we can really dwell in our cities.
What senses do you use besides sight in getting to understand the place where a building will sit?
That's a good question. Well, I think you have to use all your senses. You know, your sense of smell, your sense of touch. You have to lie down on a piece of ground, maybe in the middle of a city where you're building something, and just feel something that is not obvious about it. Because every site is not just what you see and what you can demarcate on a site plan. It extends far below you, and it's like a root of a tree that connects to other people and other histories. It's something amazing to really get in touch with the genius loci of a place. And each place is unique. You just move one foot and you're in a different place. And so to get in touch with the less visible, less apparent, to hear the voices that perhaps are whispering to you across time, you need to sort of put yourself on the same wavelength as the site. And then you might discover something amazing that is not obvious and that permits you to really develop a design.
You always keep in the back of your mind that buildings in a city contribute a lot to our ability to have collective memories of a place. And that statement has really stuck with me, because I've thought that, you know, we can come from very different neighborhoods and different backgrounds, but we sort of experience the streets that we drive down in similar ways.
Absolutely. I think architecture is sort of the great unconscious, because we all have it. We all live it. We are all experts at it. We have a place that we find ourselves in. We walk somewhere. We look out of some window. It's really the thing that connects us all. And memory is the fundamental dimension of architecture, in my view. It's not really just the three-dimensional construction and so on. It's what underlies our memory. Where did we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? What are we looking for? And those are the fundamental questions that really drive architecture as a communal effort, particularly we can tell the difference between architecture in democracies, which create open and good spaces, versus totalitarian architecture that oppresses people and sort of puts them into some sort of a line. So yes, I think memory, if you have cities that don't have memory, you forget yourself, what is happening to you. But great cities remember for you. Even if you don't remember, the city or the building will suddenly show you something that it remembers, and suddenly you remember as well. So it's really the art of memory which drives, as I see it, architecture.
A lot of important works of architecture are not really open to the public. They're there for paying customers. They're there for people who have offices or homes. But from the outside, they're accessible to anyone. How much do you think about the importance of your building working, even if people never set foot inside of it?
Well, that's a great question. You try to make the buildings as open as possible, as accessible to people, as interesting to people. Of course, buildings have their own identities, their own owners, and so on. But to create really the public space that allows one to become part of the city, and it's a place for everyone, for the stranger, for the other, for people you never met before, to create a space that has that vibrant sense of communicating something important in the world. That's what interests me.
So when you talk about communicating an idea or telling a story with a building, specifically, what do you mean by that?
Well, look, architecture isn't there to tell you something with a voice, with letters and our alphabet, but it has its own language. The language is the language of light, the language of proportions, the language of materials. By the way, the language of vibrations, because acoustics are an incredible part of space, since our sense of balance is not in our eyes, it's in our inner ear. So when you connect all those things, you suddenly realize that architecture is a language. It's its own language across time. And I think that's why really people love to travel and go to ancient buildings. They might go to a cathedral, they might go to the desert, or I might go somewhere to see a habitation that is vernacular and be in touch with those who constructed it. They can understand it without the borders of nations, the borders of cultures. You can penetrate right through and be part of that world.
So talk a little bit about the Felix Nussbaum House, which is a museum. You began the design process thinking like the entire Holocaust is almost too big for anyone to comprehend, but through the lens of a single life, we can start to understand. So how did that inform your process as you designed this building?
Well, I called it a museum without an exit, because even though it has a door, you can exit it. I wanted to make the museum into an image of Felix Nussbaum's life. Now, Felix Nussbaum was a famous painter before the Holocaust, before the war. He was, well known and so on. And his name was, he was in 1933, the nightmare began, fascism and the Nazis, and he had to escape and run away, was arrested in holding camps and escaped, and finally made it to Belgium and hid and continued to make his paintings and drawings documenting his experience. So I tried to make a building that has that topography of displacement, topography that disorients you in many ways and that puts you into Felix Nussbaum's sort of sense of being. Unfortunately, he didn't make it. He was given away by his neighbors to the Gestapo on the last deportation train to Auschwitz, and he and his wife both perished. But I wanted to create a document really that goes beyond just the aesthetics of his wonderful and beautiful paintings, but to sort of communicate the spaces that he lived in, from the space of Rolandstrasse on his beautiful little street where he had his bar mitzvah, to the suddenly displacement to Berlin, to France, to back into Belgium, and then back into the dead end of his death. And I made a museum that, it's a very modest, very small museum, but a museum that I think moves people. And indeed, people might find some discomfort. They might not find the easy way out. There's no atrium. There is no sort of some redemptive space there where you say, now I understand everything, because you're in the footsteps, in the traces of a life. And what can be more important than giving a sense what a life is? Because as you said, how can we understand millions of people in a genocide? We can't. But one person we can actually document and create a museum in a small city, Osnabrück, that is attractive, that attracts new generation people who had no idea about what happened in their own town, and many others, to enjoy the beauty of art and the sense of a life.
You've designed a number of Jewish museums in different parts of the world, which means grappling over and over with your own thinking, not just about Jewish culture and Judaism, but with the Holocaust. And I wonder if there are insights that you discovered in the process of working on all these designs, things that have clarified for you with regard to how you understand the Holocaust.
Well, it's difficult to understand the Holocaust, but, you know, the Jew was always the quintessential other, the stranger, the one excluded. And that's kind of, in a way, the definition of humanity. If you really look across nations, across, without those borders, who are we? Where are we? Where is our identity coming from? So it's a quest for understanding what a human being is and how is a human being's culture, tradition, sense of future reconciled with liberty, with freedom to think, to explore, to dream. And of course, that event, the Holocaust, the Shoah, as they say in Hebrew, is something we can hardly really understand because we cannot grasp what it means to murder so many millions of people. By people, by the way, who are well-educated, who came from good schools, who had great culture behind them, you know, of Beethoven, of Bach, of great philosophers. How did it happen? And so that communication, I discovered, cannot be just an intellectual exercise. It has to be something which is part of your emotions. You have to build an emotion into a space. And I think that's true for every building, every house. Look, think about it. One's own bedroom or living room or a place when one eats in a kitchen is an emotional space. It's not just a plan and an abstract matrix of statistics. It's a place where which we call home, which has its own special aura and spirit. And I think that's what all of architecture really is, if we sort of cross out those abstract boundaries that we draw around it.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. A lot of people were surprised that you accepted the commission to do the Military History Museum in Dresden.
Oh, yes. People said, how can you, somebody who's Jewish, whose family perished in the Holocaust, would do a museum, actually the biggest museum in Germany, the Military History Museum in Dresden is the biggest museum because German military history is so wide. But I said, why not? Germany is an amazing country. It's a democracy. It's a strong country with amazing culture that is grappling with its past in order to have a future that is meaningful. And so I accepted to do this building, which is, one of the most interesting projects because it deals with an armory which was built in 1870. Which quickly became a museum. It became the Museum of the Nazis, Museum of Stalin, Museum of the East Germans. And then when the wall fell, the question was, how do we go on with this history? What do we build now? And my project involved really building, kind of penetrating through this historical building with a vector, with a strong space that really changes the structure of the building and emerges in the front of the building where you see the beautiful panorama of the rebuilt city of Dresden, but you're also standing really in the vector of the destruction of Dresden in the 1945 Allied bombings. And you have simultaneously an experience in the winds of the city as you are suspended, basically, in front of the building. And you are in the winds of history. You're seeing the rebuilt city. You're also seeing the catastrophes that because of German militarism and horrible history between 1914 and 1945, also destroyed so much of the world. So yes, it's a visceral experience. It's hard to explain buildings with words or even with drawings. But when one enters that building, one has a sense of the question that the building asks. And when you enter from, you know, the armor itself, which I renovated, was very badly treated by the East Germans. I brought back the classic elements of that armory. And then the new vector, which penetrates the building, the questions are asked. Why do people follow authoritarian leaders? Why do people march when they are told to march? Why do people raise their guns when they're told to shoot others? And of course, no answers are given. Nobody can give answers. It's questions are posed to people who come to the museum, and it's an experience, really.
How do you want our experience on the interior of a building you designed to relate to what we see from the outside?
You always start with an interior, I think. I never start a building by just looking at the shape from the outside. You have to go from kind of within, from the inner the inner core of the building, whatever it is, whether it's a house, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a school, whether it's a housing project, you start in the center with a human being, because that's what a building is about. It's not about concrete and glass and steel. Only much later, it's really about the human being. You know, what do we do? How do we stand? Where do we sit? Where do we look? And I always think of myself, you know, I my favorite novel, Robinson Crusoe, Daniel Defoe, when he's, you know, a solitary survivor on this island where he has nothing. What does he do? He has one knife that he saved from the ship. And the first act is he builds himself a table. You know, he doesn't build, you know, some instrument, a weapon or anything. He uses the knife to build himself a table and then a chair to sit down and to start thinking what to do on the island, how to survive. That's a beautiful metaphor, really, for architecture. You have to start from inside of your thought, inside of your spirit, and then develop the space that follows.
You also design installations that will be in a place temporarily. How does your thought process compare when you are putting something in a spot that will stay for 6 months or a year or 2 years as opposed to for decades?
Well, it's the same thing. You know, my daughter's an artist, Rachel. She's a performance artist as well. So what is a performance? You see it maybe once in a lifetime and it's gone. But that doesn't mean that its power vanishes. Its ghosts continue to hover and maybe have a really dramatic impact on you much, much later on. Leonardo da Vinci, one of my favorite architects and one of the greatest artists who ever lived, did, I think, most of his work. I think he left only 10 paintings or something like that, but he did a lot of performances for his patrons, for Milan, lots of different amazing things. So yes, there's nothing lower about doing something which is temporary, because if you think about it, the whole world is temporary.
My guest is architect Daniel Libeskind. We're talking about his career, which has been written about in a new retrospective book called Edge of Order. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is architect Daniel Libeskind, who is responsible for the redesign of the World Trade Center District in Manhattan. He's got a new retrospective book about his career called Edge of Order. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Daniel, as an architect, you have a great deal of power over how people will behave within a building that you design, right? You put a door here, people have to go in or out there. Depending on the way you put the rooms, people will move in a certain way. I know that you also think about how people have used the space before. So will you talk a little bit about the City Life Complex in Milan?
Yes, I think every project has to depend on a tradition of a place. No place is just a tabula rasa where you just start with an empty piece of paper and you start something. You have to get in touch with how did people live here hundreds of years ago? And that tradition continued, of course, in Milan. So in my project for City Life, I sought to create, really, it's a completely 21st century project, but I based it on the life of Milan, where buildings have really well-crafted history, where people enjoy public life in the streets, where kids play in the courtyards. So even though it is a completely rethinking of scale and of sustainability and of really creating new green space in a city that has so much hard, asphalt like Milan, to create a new sense of a place that is connected with its traditions. And I think that's really the challenge, because if you can't just put something that looks like a flying saucer on top and think that it will, you know, work well. But you do have to do something which is really very new, very different, and yet somehow it's connected to the links of the past, which are meaningful. And I think that's what gives a sense that people want to live there and will enjoy life in a newer way.
With any project, you are working for your client, but sometimes you write that you have to help the client understand what they want, even if they don't know yet what they want. How do you talk people through that?
Well, the best way to talk to people, clients or others, is to show them a drawing or even a small cardboard model, because it's very hard to talk about architecture abstractly. But the minute you make a drawing, the minute you know, when I did my project for the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, it's the largest museum in Canada, I really drew it as a series of sketches on a napkin, because I love napkins, because they spread the ink so nicely. And I sent it as my entry. And then, of course, some people were horrified that I didn't, you know, do the computer renderings. But, you know, it's not the first time. You know, Le Corbusier himself was disqualified from his famous building of League of Nations because he used the wrong ink. So, but at the core is the idea, which connects your eye, your brain, your hand with the future. And that's a sketch. And everything really comes out of a sketch, which is such a modest little thing. And yet everything goes into that thought about people, about history, about what it will look like. And then, of course, you have to communicate to a client who might be very skeptical, might not even understand that this is real, that even though it looks different, it can be built, it can be efficient, it will be cost effective, it will not be more expensive, it will be on budget and on time, but it will have new qualities that you want to embody in that building and in that city block.
You have had major projects suddenly lose a third of their funding and had to adjust to that. What is that like?
Well, architecture is, you know, if you can survive in architecture, you understand the world, because architecture is a, you know, very important art, but it's also so dependent on the world, on politics, on money, on different winds of change. So when my building for the Imperial War Museum was suddenly, you know, they didn't get the funding of the, you know, lottery in England. And so the building suddenly was slashed in its budget. And my clients thought, okay, now we will not build the building. I thought, no, the idea is to communicate a meaning. What does Imperial War Museum North mean to people? It will show the conflicts in people in which people fought and still fight today. It will bring people together to understand something about their neighborhood, you know, where millions of people fought in these conflicts take place. So I said, no, even though the budget has been slashed by, you know, 35%, I'll just rethink it. I won't drop the idea, which was based on my idea that the globe is shattered. You know, it's not the globe you see in a logo, which is nice and homogeneous and perfect sphere. It's a globe which is broken in conflict. And I was very inspired by Winston Churchill, one of my favorite thinkers, who said that conflicts, there will always be a conflict. There will never be a time without a conflict. But it's how we steer those conflicts in a positive way that can make the world a better place. So I used that concept, and I did finally create a building that is based on those shards, the air shard, earth shard, water shard, and exhibits inside, which are very sort of emotional and beautiful. And yet the building is, you know, 35-40% lower cost than the original building was supposed to be. So you have to do everything possible to realize a building if you believe in it.
You started by dropping a teapot out the window.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one thing to think about the shards and globe broken, but I wanted to see, what does it really look like? What does a sphere which is broken look like? So I had a teapot, kind of a traditional, really English teapot, which is almost spherical completely. I put it into a little plastic bag, and I dropped it from our first story window in our studio in Berlin. And I went down and picked it up. And indeed, there were like a few shards. You know, when I built the building, I couldn't incorporate all the shards, but my original project had all of them. But I had the four shards. So anyway, it permitted me to really look at a physical object and to be inspired by it, just the way one can be inspired by, you know, by a poem or by an artwork or a piece of literature.
It seems that a lot of your designs over the years have acknowledged both the goodness and the benevolence of people and the horrible things that people do, sometimes in the same work. And I think a lot of people recognize that those things coexist, but can't accept them to the extent that they just want one to be true, or they only want to focus on the part that is horrible. Why do you think you're able to hold those ideas simultaneously in your brain and in your heart?
Well, I think life is more than just a cartoon of itself. Emily Dickinson, my favorite poet, said, "To fill a gap, insert the thing that caused it."
Hmm.
Wow. I had that poem in my mind when I looked at Ground Zero. She didn't say, you know, repress it, forget about it, cover it up. In fact, she goes on to say, you cannot cover an abyss. You know, you cannot just cover the abyss. You have to acknowledge it. So I don't believe that buildings should, and places should just repress what happened, repress. They have to show everything. But of course, always with the goal of offering hope, offering something really beautiful. Because that's, without it, you wouldn't do a museum devoted to catastrophes. Or you wouldn't build anything on a ground where so many thousands of people perished. You have to have a goal, which is hope, a better world, a deeper understanding of where we are. And that requires, I think, struggling between the events that are irreversible. You can't change those events. They are there. They can never be changed again. But you can change the future by offering people a sense of being part of something that moves into a better light, quite physically even. So at Ground Zero, for example, you know, no one said not to build the buildings in the center, but I thought it was just not right to build where people had perished. Though no one acknowledged that the center of that site was, you know, it was just a piece of real estate. I thought it was sacred. The bedrock of that space, it was sacred. Even not to build anything, create a public space, create the memory, bring the footprints of the buildings, put the names, bring the waterfalls, which was also part of my idea, in order to screen the busy sounds of traffic in Lower Manhattan, and let every person have their own experience of standing on that site in a public space that really we all share. And there's a kind of solidarity of people, wherever they come from, they feel something emotional, and they then can look at, you know, a renaissance of Lower Manhattan with all those fantastic buildings around them. But I think the core is really that sense of memory, connection of the memory into the future.
As we move into the future, of course, there will be generations that don't have an emotional connection to these events, just as there are now, you know, generations that don't feel a direct emotional connection to the Holocaust. How much do you think about your work having meaning for people that don't necessarily know these events except through the pages of history books?
That's the core. I think you really said the profound thing, that you have to create a space that continues to be alive. It's not a space that is dedicated just to the past and to something that is forgettable, but create a vivid space that moves someone in new ways. It's never going to be the same for a person born 5 years later, 10 years later, 15 years later. Space will always change. But if you structure the space in a way which offers spontaneity to perception, which offers a shift of perspective of light, if you offer a sense of new kind of dignity where you occupy the space with others, I think people will always find those spaces interesting. Because they are not based on a style, they're not based on a fashion, they are not based purely on some convention. They are based on something that acknowledges that each person is unique, each person is uniquely qualified to form their own space out of the structures that you actually built, which are not movable, which are permanent.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You say that when you go back and visit your projects sometime after they've been completed, they often feel more alive to you than when they first opened. So how do spaces change as they actually start to get used by people?
Well, people treat them in different ways. Sometimes they change even the program. You designed one space for X, and suddenly that space is changed to another space. They need another space. But I think good buildings, great buildings, are flexible because they can change, you know, they can outlive their local function, so to speak, and adapt themselves to a new function. And so the building has to be in some way interesting and flexible for people who use the building. And I also enjoy how people sometimes put, you know, pink curtains in a building where I imagined, you know, it's going to be a white, you know, perfect plane. And I kind of enjoy it because it shows the inventiveness of people. People are alive. People have their own dreams. And I think when I make a building, I always think how it's going to look. Of course, some things are immovable. You can't move a concrete wall. But you can offer people a freedom to imagine other things in the building that you have built and allow them to have transformed the building. And I think that's not only healthy, but also beautiful in terms of the social use of buildings.
it requires setting your ego aside in a way that, that members of your profession are not famous for doing.
Well, look, in truth, I often thought about it. Architecture attracts authoritarian personalities.
Huh.
You know, it attracts people who want to impose their sort of power. And it's not by coincidence that Stalin and Mussolini and Hitler and, you know, other people, you know, who built think of themselves as architects. They're going to change the world and you know, do their own thing. But I think in a democracy, and I think that's the core of my architecture, you have to allow the different forces to struggle and to express the space as something very dynamic, not a monotone, but a kind of polyphony of possibilities. And that, of course, means that the buildings will be different, will not be homogeneous, will not be just of a one kind. They'll be heterogeneous. They'll have differences within themselves, and that they will, you will find a different corner in each person will find a different corner in it. So that's part of I think how one can really thrive in a democracy, whereas in a totalitarian environment where people just impose a tower over here and it's going to look that way and you just find yourself below the tower, that's not very healthy.
You say that the architect starts the conversation and the rest is up to us. How can we respond in a meaningful way to architecture?
Well, I have been at so many meetings. You know, each of my projects, many of them most of them, I would say, are all public projects. People are, you know, the stakeholders are the people. It's not just a powerful client, but people. Meetings to create a project like Ground Zero or the Jewish Museum Berlin or other buildings require sometimes hundreds, if not thousands of people. And I often listen to people. I always listen to people, but often listen to the most silent voices. What do people think? What do they want? What are their ideas? And that's, I think, the beauty of architecture. You listen to the voices, and often the voices that are not in the forefront, but in the background. And you have to understand them, and they have to appeal to you, and you have to be able to interpret the desire into something which is physical, which is a three-dimensional space built out of a real material. But that's a beautiful process. I am every project I've built virtually is a participatory project. Even a house which I built in Connecticut, you know, I had to go through approvals of all the neighbors. You know, why does the building look this way? You know, why is it shaped that way? Why doesn't it have a peaked roof and so on? So yes, that's the beauty of architecture. It's a public art.
The retrospective book of architect Daniel Libeskind's work is called Edge of Order. Daniel, it has been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you. Such a pleasure. Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. My handle is at Chris Boyd Think, and you can use any podcast app to download the Think podcast and subscribe. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.